Well, another great story breaking about Egypt's Great Pyramid. They're seeing some heat spots there, and they're beginning to think, oh my gosh, what's going on there? What, some more chambers? What? So it's another great story there. Hey, the man who rocked the world with his best-selling book, Fingerprints of the Gods, doing it again with Magicians of the Gods. And in a moment, Graham Hancock joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Graham Hancock back with us. He is recognized as one of those thinkers who deal with humanity's history. Like I said, he did it with Fingerprints of the Gods. Sold, gosh, Graham, how many of those did you sell? Millions, 5 million, didn't you?
Somewhere of the order of 7 million around the world.
Ah, good for you.
The book was a phenomenal success in Japan, and it sold 2.5 million copies in hardback there. Total surprise to me. In fact, the whole phenomenon of Fingerprints of the Gods was a surprise to me, but a great surprise. Very interesting change of direction in my life.
And you've got another one starting here with Magicians of the Gods. Good job.
Yep. Published today in the United States, Magicians of the Gods is the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods. And the reason I've written it, I wrote Fingerprints 20 years ago, the reason I've written it is that there's just a huge amount of radically important new information which sheds a completely new light on the mystery of the lost civilization. For a long time, I felt I wouldn't go back to this, but as the evidence kept piling up, it became obvious that I had to write a new book, and that's what Magicians of the Gods is all
good
about.
And you're going to be touring all over the country, New York, Miami, San Francisco, L.A., Boston, Denver, Boulder.
That's right. That's right. Seattle, Portland.
Wow.
We're going everywhere. I'm in New York at the moment, and I'm in America for the next 5 weeks through until December the 16th. We have a full list of my events published on grahamhancock.com, my website, and it's constantly being updated with new events.
So you get back before Christmas, at least, huh?
I just get back a week ahead of Christmas. We arrive back in England on the 17th of December.
What's going on in England these days? You know, we're topsy-turvy here in the United States.
It's a miserable place. I mean, we have the chronic problem that so many countries in the industrialized world have now of a corrupt, dishonest, lying, cowardly, malignant government, you know. This is the problem. I mean, they're just a bunch of freeloaders taking the taxpayers' money and wasting it and telling us lies.
Are people fed up out there, Graham?
Fed up, absolutely fed up, as I think they are all around the world.
Yeah,
with the dishonesty
really
of the political process. We need change. We need real change.
Well, let's have a relief over the next 3 hours here and just let our minds wander into some of these great mysteries that you've uncovered. Let's go back for a lot of people. Let's do a little review of the Fingerprints of the Gods, because that set the stage for Magicians of the Gods.
It did.
When you put this together, this work, what did you see? Because this isn't something somebody just wakes up and says, I'm going to write a book about this. What happened?
Well, what happened was I'd been involved in studying ancient history for some time. I'd written a book before Fingerprints of the Gods called The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant. This was the book that really drew me into the ancient mysteries arena. And while I was researching that earlier book, The Sign and the Seal, I had to travel to Egypt as part of the research for that book, and I was just stunned by my first sight of the pyramids and the Great Sphinx of Giza, and it tickled my curiosity, although it wasn't relevant to the book I was writing at the time, The Sign and the Seal. And I started to look into it, and I kept on coming across information that was not explained by mainstream history. The mainstream history began to read more like a kind of ideology of the past rather than an accurate description of the past, a feeling of how historians wanted the past to be rather than how it definitely was, and a sense that they missed out on important pieces of evidence and did not convey the implications of that evidence to us properly. And gradually what it began to look like to me was that way back, deep in the night of time, there had been an earlier civilization, one that wasn't recognized in mainstream history and archaeology at all, and that it had passed down an influence all around the world, which explained the many common factors that we find in many different cultures all around the world, and that what had happened to this civilization was a cataclysm, some tremendous disaster had overtaken the earth. And as I homed in more and more on the research, it became obvious, the time frame became obvious, This was somewhere around 12,500 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that that was the end of the Ice Age and that there had been cataclysmic events at the end of the Ice Age. But I think one of the problems with Fingerprints of the Gods was that I couldn't absolutely, backed up by hard science, I could not absolutely put my finger on precisely what that cataclysm was. I speculated, I explored, particularly the intriguing theory of earth crust displacement of Charles Hapgood, which was, you know, subsequently refined and developed greatly by Rand and Rose Flemmath. And this was an important influence on my work in Fingerprints of the Gods. But the problem with that was that there's no mainstream scientific backing for it at all. And so people were left wondering, particularly those of a skeptical frame of mind, were left wondering, well, Hancock's saying there's been this cataclysm, but what was it really? We don't see science recognizing a big cataclysm 12,500 years ago. And that's one of the very new things with Magicians of the Gods, is that we now have the absolute rock-solid science on what that cataclysm was and how it was connected to the end of the Ice Age.
Oh, and when we get into it, it's going to shake a lot of people. It really will. Now, when this civilization was obliterated, are these the Atlanteans that we hear so much about or some other civilization?
No, I think that the Atlantis story that's been passed down to us by Plato, in fact, he's the oldest source we presently have of the Atlantis story, is indeed an account of this lost civilization. And the reason that there are many reasons I think that, but one of the most intriguing is that Plato actually gives us a date for the submergence of Atlantis, for its destruction in a single terrible day and night that left mankind to begin again like children,
yes,
with no memory of what went before. And that date is 9,000 years before the time of Solon. And Solon was the Greek lawmaker. He was an ancestor of Plato. And he had visited Egypt around 600 BC. And there he had been told by the priests of a temple in the Delta the story of Atlantis. And they told him that Atlantis had gone down 9,000 years before their time. So since that time was 600 BC, we're talking 9,600 BC, in other words, 11,600 years ago. And that turns out to be one of two dates, the other one was 12,800 years ago, when cataclysmic events indeed unfolded upon this planet. And the event of 11,600 years ago was accompanied by a gigantic, rapid, sudden sea level rise that is referred to as Meltwater Pulse 1B. In other words, extensive global flooding. And that's exactly what Plato talked about. So the accusation that Plato made Atlantis up has to be set at rest now when we realize that he gave the date that science and geology in the 21st century has only recently homed in on.
Isn't that incredible?
The date of a cataclysmic event. It is truly, truly incredible, and I think it brings Plato's Atlantis story out of the shadows, and it should come back into center stage. This is one of the precious accounts we have of a forgotten episode in human history.
How advanced was this civilization, Graham, before the tragedy occurred?
My sense is, first of all, that it was a very different civilization from our own. This was a civilization, I think, that explored and developed the faculties of the human mind. You might even refer to them as psi faculties. Our culture has gone down a particular route of development, which is to do with mechanical advantage. We make machines. We make technology. We extend our limited physical powers with machinery. We extend our brain power with machinery in computers, for example. My sense from studying this material many years is that the lost civilization we're looking at was much more interested in the powers of the human mind, and those powers have become latent. They've fallen into disrepair in our society today. People still have them, but they're not exercising them. They're not engaged. The truck, if you like, is not in gear. And I think the power of the human mind, the ability to manipulate matter directly with the human mind, telekinesis, telepathy, all such issues, there's many hints that this is the character of the civilization we're looking at. When it comes to technology, what I can say pretty much for sure is that a level of technology had been achieved more than 12,000 years ago, which was at least equivalent to the level of technology that we had on planet Earth at the beginning of the 19th century or in the late 18th
century. Truly amazing. Truly amazing.
That's my thought. And this was a civilization that explored and mapped the world during the Ice Age. And as I reported, indeed, in Fingerprints of the Gods, some of those maps have come down to us.
I have always thought that we had an advanced civilization, Graham, whether it was ET related or just by evolution, that got to the moon. And, you know, that some of the artifacts that may be on the moon were left behind by these ancient people who literally had the ability to travel in space.
Well, that's an intriguing possibility, and I don't completely rule that out by any means. And indeed, looking at our immediate cosmic environment, you may recall I wrote a book called The Mars Mystery back in the 1990s,
exactly.
which looks at the anomalies on Mars. There do seem to be some objects, some artifacts on nearby planetary bodies, including the moon, which certainly look artificial. Can I say man-made? I don't know. We need to investigate this more. At the moment, we only have photographs. We need much more. We need much more than that. But you know, new information is coming in all the time, and I think we have to keep an open mind.
Now, back to the ancient civilization. Might they have been ET-related in terms of technology and help?
Well, let me make clear that I am not an advocate of the ancient astronaut theory.
Okay.
And that's for a number of reasons. Firstly, I need to be absolutely clear that I have nothing against the idea of ancient astronauts or of alien intervention in human affairs. We won't talk about this at length tonight, but I have had experience of contact with intelligences, with non-human intelligences. But those experiences have been achieved by altering my state of consciousness,
right,
using the South American visionary brew called ayahuasca. And I have had classic ET contact experiences in that state. And I think that one of the things that we need to do to investigate this mystery further, just as we investigate the physical aspects of the alien abduction phenomenon, we should also be deeply investigating its implications for consciousness. And the possibility that by changing our state of consciousness, we may contact and communicate with non-human intelligences. I think that's worthy of real deep research. That being said, having spent a quarter of a century traveling the most intriguing, the most beautiful, exciting, and mysterious ancient archaeological sites in the world, really walking the walk, investigating and exploring these sites, not just reading about them, but being there with my feet on the ground, sometimes for months, the conclusion I've come to is that I have not seen anything in any of these mysterious ancient sites that I could only explain with a culture that had the technology to cross interstellar space. What I see is evidence of incredible advancement way beyond the period of time, at a time when human beings are supposed to have just been hunter-gatherers. We see evidence of huge advancement and great technical skill and knowledge, but I am of the opinion, I'm not going to completely rule the alien aspect out, but I'm of the opinion that what we are dealing with is a lost, advanced human civilization, and that it much more brilliantly explains the anomalies that are raised by the ancient astronaut lobby than the notion of ancient astronauts themselves. In other words, I think that these ancient and mysterious sites around the world are very poor evidence for the ancient astronaut hypothesis. I don't think they serve it well. When you really investigate those sites, the notion that aliens were involved in building them doesn't make sense. For example, the Great Pyramid is an incredibly precise and accurate monument, 6 million tons, 13-acre footprint, and it's just 3/60ths of a single degree off true north. But hey, if you can cross interstellar space and navigate all the way to this pale blue dot, and you're involved in some way in building the pyramid, you are going to get it dead on true north. Not 3/60ths of a degree off. So that looks like human error to me, but it looks like the human error of a very advanced culture.
And they may have used sound resonance to move those blocks. Who knows what they did?
I think you're onto a really important point there. I think sound was one of the techniques they used. And again, there are many traditions. I go into this in Magicians of the Gods. There are many traditions of sound being used to levitate large blocks of stone, which, of course, our archaeologists dismiss as simple fantasy. I think we should be listening to those accounts.
And I would guess, Graham, that this advanced civilization probably had no foreknowledge of their doom.
I don't think so. It's a complicated story, George, because we're actually talking about an episode that lasted for 1,200 years. The cataclysm began 12,800 years ago, but there was a second episode of cataclysm 11,600 years ago. So before the first episode, I don't think they knew. But in the period between the first and the second episode, there were still survivors of that civilization. And I think they then knew what they were dealing with. And I think they set about a conscious project to preserve their knowledge mm-hmm. and to pass it down to the future, just as we would do if our civilization faced total destruction. We would want not everything to be lost. We'd want to pass something down. And I think that's what happened.
Graham, were these calamities related to each other, even though there was a span of 1,200 years?
Yes, the same object caused them both. They are absolutely related to each other, very closely related to each other.
Now, 20 years ago, of course, with Fingerprints of the Gods, time has buzzed by.
Mm-hmm.
Has anything been new? Has any new discoveries been created?
George, there's just been incredible new discoveries. First of all, and we'll go into this no doubt in the next segment, but first of all, we have the absolute hard scientific evidence of an extinction-level event that occurred 12,800 years ago and repeated itself 11,600 years ago. And then we have the emergence of incredible archaeological sites like Göbekli Tepe in mm-hmm. Turkey, which is 11,600 years old, spot on exactly that date, a gigantic megalithic site 50 times larger than Stonehenge in England and 7,000 years older than Stonehenge. There is no precedent. There is no background to Göbekli Tepe. It just comes out of nowhere. And then after they've made it, the people who made it deliberately buried it and hid it away like a time capsule, untouched for more than 10,000 years until it was rediscovered and excavated in the second half of the 1990s.
Amazing. Graham,
that's one of many sites. There's another site in Indonesia called Gunung Padang, a pyramid that may go back more than 20,000 years. New evidence is just coming out of the woodwork all the time, and the old paradigm of history, the old model of history, cannot explain that evidence.
Is science starting to back some of this up?
Yes. It is definitely being backed up by science. Now that we know that an extinction-level event occurred in that window between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago, many hard scientists are saying this must have had implications for history. The only people who are ignoring it so far are the archaeologists. I don't want to blame them completely. This is new information. It's only begun to filter out into the public domain since 2007, and perhaps that's, you know, not enough time for archaeologists to incorporate it into their models of the origin of civilization. But they need to get on with it, otherwise they're going to be left behind in a rush of change of ideas.
Is it difficult for them to basically come down to earth and agree to these kinds of possibilities?
Yes, I think it's very difficult. Like any strongly held belief, and archaeologists do have a strongly held belief that their view of the past is correct, we tend to identify our strongly held beliefs with our own persons, with our very being. So an attack on those beliefs can be easily construed as an attack on us as individuals, as people. And when we're attacked as individuals and people, the natural reaction is to become very defensive, to become very territorial, to circle the wagons and drive off the intruder. And that's how archaeology behaves towards this new information at the moment. I think they feel very threatened. I think they feel psychologically threatened at the level of individuals by this information.
We're going to come back and talk about the calamities, two huge calamities that changed this planet. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Graham Hancock with us, his new book, Magicians of the Gods. Graham, these two calamities, these catastrophes that occurred between 12,800 and 11,600 BC. What happened?
12,800 years ago and 11,600 years ago. So that's 10,800 BC to 9,600 BC. What happened was the Earth was hit by fragments of a giant comet. This is very new science, but it's not often understood that comets can go up to 200 miles in diameter. There's a vast population of comets in an area in the outer solar system called the Oort cloud. There's more than a trillion comets in there. And as the solar system goes in orbit around the center of the galaxy, at the center of our Milky Way galaxy is a humongous black hole out of which all our reality at some point in the past poured. And we are in orbit around that black hole. It's a colossal orbit that takes hundreds of millions of years to complete. And during that orbit, the solar system and the Earth amongst it doesn't simply orbit in the plane of the galaxy, but it kind of dives up and down through the plane of the galaxy, a bit like a porpoise or a dolphin swimming through the sea. And every time it crosses the plane of the galaxy, gravitational disturbances are unleashed upon the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt, the two main sources of comets. And they can send comets from those very distant, very safe orbits flying in towards the inner solar system, where they can be captured by the sun and can go into orbits that cross the orbit of the Earth. A lot of people think that comets are just dirty snowballs, but that is not the case. Comets are huge chunks of rock bound together by ice. And what happens with comets is that they have a tendency to break up into multiple lethal fragments. I think all of us can remember 1994 and the spectacular firework display put on by comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, when it broke into 20 fragments.
Into Jupiter they went.
And pounded into the giant planet, Jupiter. Now, this was not a very big comet. This was a comet only 2 kilometers in diameter. It broke into 20 pieces, but those 20 pieces, each one of those explosions on the surface of Jupiter, had more power than all the nuclear weapons on Earth being exploded at once. If those objects had hit the Earth, we would have been in real trouble in 1994. But they did not, because our Earth is protected by the planet Jupiter. The planet Jupiter is the giant guardian of our planet. As a matter of fact, there would be no life on Earth if it wasn't for the protective role played by Jupiter.
Is because of Jupiter's size, Graham, it just sucks it in with its gravity?
Yeah. Gigantic gravity, massive gravity, and it's circling out there like a watchman in the outer solar system, and it just grabs the comets that are coming into the inner solar system and it pulverizes them. It's big enough. It can take it. So I wake up every day and say, thank you, Jupiter. You know,
a great design for us, wasn't it?
Yeah, great design for us. And the Greeks maybe were not wrong when they saw Jupiter as a god, you know, as the ancients did. But every now and then a comet gets through, and we see them in our skies. And this is what happened. The calculations of the astronomers are that it happened actually about 20,000 years ago, that a huge comet in the range of 200 miles in diameter entered the inner solar system and went into an orbit that crosses the orbit of the Earth. For about 8,000 years, there was no problem. The Earth missed it. Mm-hmm. But the comet started to break up into fragments, some big, some small. And 12,800 years ago, the Earth crossed the path of a bunch of those fragments. And they hit the Earth. And the epicenter of the cataclysm was the North American ice cap. 12,800 years ago, we were still in the ice age. There were ice sheets that were best part of 2 miles deep, covering North America and Northern Europe. And four fragments of the comet, each of them are in the range of about a mile in diameter, smashed into the North American ice cap. And there they did a number of things. First of all, when you have an object like this coming in, you have to bear in mind it's traveling at about 70,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
And it's a mile wide, okay? This thing is packing an unbelievable amount of heat and kinetic energy. And that heat and kinetic energy explodes as it hits the Earth. There's an enormous outpouring of ejecta from the initial impact, which flies up into the upper atmosphere, superheated ejecta, bits of the comet itself, bits of the Earth, fly up into the upper atmosphere. They can descend hundreds or even thousands of miles away, still hot, where they can set forests on fire. And this is was the first bit of evidence that the scientists followed, is evidence of global wildfires burning 12,800 years ago, leaving a layer of soot, a distinct layer of soot, a stratum of soot in the soil, dating back to that time. Then as they began to investigate further, they found that this stratum contained other things. It contained nanodiamonds, tiny, tiny diamonds, only visible under a microscope. It contained carbon spherules. It contained evidence of colossal temperatures in excess of 2,200 degrees centigrade above the boiling point of quartz. And this evidence, this black stratum, this black sooty stratum and the embedded impact proxies, because these kind of things, the nanodiamonds, melt glass, for example, very like nuclear melt glass.
That's right.
Are the classic indicators of a cosmic impact, and now they're finding them all over the world. So they really start to investigate this and home in on it, and the conclusion they come to is that we were hit by a massive rain of comet fragments, and that it changed the world forever. Now, initially, there are more than 30 of these scientists, and I want to be clear to our listeners that we are dealing in this case with mainstream, highly credentialed Earth scientists. These are not people out on the fringe. These are people mm-hmm. absolutely at the center.
Pure scientists.
Pure scientists. And they're publishing in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in the Journal of Geology, in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, and so on and so forth. Now, initially, their work was opposed. The argument was, how could there have been an impact? We don't find any crater. We just find these impact proxies. But every criticism that was made of the research has been completely refuted, and almost every day new evidence comes in. We are now starting to find craters. The reason craters were difficult to find, of course, was that the major impacts were on the North American ice cap. The craters were excavated in ice that was 2 miles deep, and the ice melted away, leaving almost no trace
no
of
trace.
The crater. But it did leave shock effects on the ground beneath the ice, and a number of areas in the northeast of North America have been identified as craters that were caused by these impacts. And in fact, the fallout of the impacts goes as far to the east as Syria. It covers 50 million square miles Jeez. Of the Earth's surface, but the heart of it all was in North America, and something truly terrible happened here 12,800 years ago.
The sound, Graham, in the explosions must have been deafening.
Those who lived at that time must have found it literally an experience of the end of the world. Terrible sound and shock, the Earth shaking. The Earth's crust is destabilized by these impacts. You get colossal earthquakes, volcanoes blow. At the same time, the wildfires, the continent-wide wildfires that are set off by the superheated ejecta, fill the air with dense smoke. So when we remember many myths and traditions that speak of a time of darkness and a terrible flood, it's casting back to those very events, those cataclysmic events that happened 12,800 years ago. There were huge numbers of animal extinctions at that time. This is one of the reasons that the scientists got onto this problem, because at exactly that period, 12,800 years ago, we get a massive spike in the extinction of megafauna, the mammoths, the woolly rhino, creatures like that. They just went extinct. And something else happened as well. Global climate, which had been warming up 12,800 years ago, suddenly reversed and went into an incredible, radical deep freeze, as cold or colder than it had been at the very peak of the Ice Age. And that radical deep freeze lasted for 1,200 years. And then 11,600 years ago, equally mysteriously, the global temperature massively shot up at levels that would just daze and confuse advocates of global warming today. I mean, it was just way
right.
beyond any kind of warming that anybody is speculating about. It was just literally out of this world.
We didn't have factories and cars then.
No, No, but something radically changed global climate. And what we now know it was this comet. Some fragments hit the Earth 12,800 years ago, hit the North American ice cap, hit as far east as Syria, caused a global cataclysm, which included a sudden and immediate sea level rise at that time, because a lot of ice off the North American ice cap was melted suddenly and flowed into the Atlantic Ocean, where it then interrupted the Gulf Stream. That's the reason that temperatures went down. But then, of course, other fragments of the comet are still in orbit, around the original track of the comet. And 11,600 years ago, we hit at least one other large fragment of that comet. And this time, it hits an ocean. The evidence suggests it was the Pacific Ocean.
Like a tsunami.
And immediately, yeah. Colossal tsunami. There's evidence of gigantic global flooding 11,600 years ago. But something else, the water vapor that's thrown up into the upper atmosphere enshrouds the Earth for more than 20 years.
Jeez.
And this creates a greenhouse effect. And it's that greenhouse effect that accounts for the sudden radical rise in temperatures that occurred 11,600 years ago. So the same object caused the beginning and the end of the cataclysm.
Was this the period of Noah?
Well, I think that you need to look at the Noah story, the story of Noah's Ark, in its global context. It's one of actually thousands of stories that speak of global floods and survivors who sought to preserve something of the former world, to preserve and pass on the knowledge. And the Noah story and the story of Noah's Ark fits perfectly into that. What's intriguing about that story, of course, is that it has the Ark coming to rest on the mountains of Ararat.
That's right.
And Ararat today is within the territory of Turkey. And it's only a few days' walk from the incredible site of Göbekli Tepe. And I can't help feeling that there's a connection with the Noah story and the Göbekli Tepe mystery.
And you've got some incredible pictures. You've got that one colored picture of Mount Ararat in the background of some structures. That's
Mount Ararat
picture.
Used to belong to Armenia, you see.
That's right.
And it looms actually over the Armenian capital city of Yerevan, like a haunting mist in the distance. But the Armenians themselves cannot go there to their sacred mountain, which is actually on the coat of arms of their country, because that mountain is now in the territory of Turkey. And terrible things happened to the Armenians between 1915 and 1923. A horrendous genocide
Yes.
was unleashed upon them. And Armenia is another country that I visited and researched for Magicians of the Gods. That whole area of the Middle East is absolutely intriguing, and we have very important clues there to our lost past.
I lost a lot of family members during the 20s there, Graham.
Yes, it was
way.
A terrible time, George. It was sure. a terrible time. It's forgotten now. I feel my heart is touched by the Armenian people and what has happened to the Armenians and how so much of the world is refusing to recognize the Armenian Holocaust. There were more than 2 million Armenians who were killed by the Turks, and to this day the Turks have never apologized for it.
Nope, not at all. So the remnants of this object, is it totally broken up now, or are there still fragments out there?
No, this is the alarming.
Oh, prospect. Boy.
And it's a prospect that we should be doing something about. We're probably the first civilization on this planet that has the technical ability to sweep clean our cosmic environment. We can make the Earth safe for all life for the future, if we choose to do so. But right now, we're spending the big bucks on military technology. We're spending the big bucks on weapons of mass destruction.
That's
billions
right.
of dollars spent around the world every year, building up military forces so that we can attack and threaten and harm one another. Meanwhile, nobody is paying any attention to the skies. Less than $20 million a year is being spent on Space Watch, looking out for potentially hazardous asteroids and comets. That's just chump change by comparison with military budgets that run into trillions of dollars. So if we actually want to do something about this problem, and it's a serious one, then we have the capacity to do it. The question is, will we choose to do it, or will we carry on behaving in this ridiculous way that we behave now, generating hatred and fear and suspicion and paranoia, dividing ourselves from one another and wasting our lives away in these fruitless pursuits? What is needed is a new positive spirit. This is a cause that the whole of humanity can pull together on. And if we did pull together on it, we could absolutely avert the problem.
What kind of in orbit might these remnants still be on?
Calculations indicate that at least one of them is 30 kilometers in diameter. If that were to hit the Earth, I wouldn't like to describe what the consequences would be.
Yeah, because...
And that there are more than 100 objects up there in the range of 1 to 2 kilometers in diameter.
The dinosaur killer was what, 6?
Dinosaur killer was 10.
10.
10 kilometers in diameter. But 4 or 5 1- and 2-kilometer objects hitting the Earth, which is what happened 12,800 years ago, has an equivalent effect to the dinosaur killer.
Oh, my God. So where might this series of objects be at this point?
They're the Taurid meteor stream. The Earth is passing through it at the moment.
Oh.
We are in the Taurid meteor stream right now.
That's ironic.
It's very curious that that's the case. It takes 12 days for the Earth to pass through the Taurid meteor stream, because the Taurid meteor stream is 30 million kilometers wide, and the Earth travels at 2.5 million kilometers a day on its orbital path. So 12 days to pass through it, and we pass through it twice a year.
12 days of treachery.
12 days of treachery, and what we usually see is, you know, shooting stars. Some people call them the Halloween fireworks, fireballs in the sky, pretty things, pretty lights. They don't seem to threaten us, and that's because we're passing through filaments of the stream that only contain small objects.
Right.
But it's rather like strapping on a blindfold and opting twice a year to cross a six-lane highway.
Graham, would we see these objects coming our way?
No. There wouldn't be time. If the Earth's orbit, which constantly shifts slightly, and the calculations indicate that we enter an area of danger in the next 30 years, if we were to encounter one of these large objects in the Taurid meteor stream, we would have almost no warning at all.
Oh, geez.
It would happen very, very suddenly, and that's why we need to be proactive and start spending resources on really studying this stream, as astronomers like Victor Klug and Bill Napier and the late Sir Fred Hoyle have done for many years, and attempted to draw the world's attention to the danger there. And as I say, it's not doom and gloom, George. I'm not going around saying the end of the world is nigh. I'm saying that we have a problem here, and we have the capacity to deal with it. Light and life need not go out. We can continue, but we need to make the choice.
We need to. When we come back, Graham, I want you to take us through a scenario of what happens if we get hit with one of these objects, the 30-kilometer one, and kind of explain what the planet will be like if we get hit. So much more to talk with Graham Hancock about. His brand-new book is called Magicians of the Gods, and his website, grahamhancock.com. Go to it, because he might be in a city where you live, because he's on his tour. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.